daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will tell you stories along with John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, less than 30 minutes into a discussion of bioinformatics, student Chu Xing Jun's class was suddenly ended. It was the first day of an unusual school term. Across China, schools are closed in an effort to contain the new coronavirus that has killed some 3,000 people. Chu's class was one of tens of thousands from grade school to university that have been forced to go online for an undecided amount of time. Chu's professor was sending voice recordings to the online class group discussion when, without warning, the system ended the class. It had violated China's strong internet laws. The students did not know the nature of the violation. Was it something about the subject matter? Bioinformatics is the science of collecting and examining complex biological data. Chu, who spoke to Reuters about the incident, said, "I guess we touched on some sensitive topic." Major social media sites, including Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, are blocked in China. The country's government closely watches similar sites created in China, such as Weibo and WeChat. Chinese security agents remove information considered offensive. Now, the sudden arrival of public education onto such sites has brought new attention to government controls over the internet. Biology courses in recent weeks have been blocked for pornographic content. History and politics classes are among the most at risk of shutdowns. Subjects such as China's Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward are commonly censored in classes and online discussions. Daily life in the world's most populous nation has changed greatly in the last 6 weeks. Streets that are usually full of activity are now empty. Fast food restaurants offer only takeout service. And group activities have been replaced with online substitutes. Classes have stopped, but learning will not, the education ministry said in a February notice. It has established 24,000 free online studies on 22 websites. Yet the country's internet security agents have interfered with many of these substitute educational programs. Louis Wang is a middle school history teacher in northeast China. He said his workload has expanded greatly because of a difficult approval process for online classes. "Every word that is spoken in a video recording must be pre-approved," Wang said. For him, that means writing his class lectures word for word, about 5,000 Chinese characters each, for school administrators to examine. Even seemingly neutral statements can cause a problem with the censors. Wang said one of his co-workers, a politics teacher, was trying to upload a document that included the words Socialism with Chinese Characteristics in its name. That expression was made famous by former leader Deng Xiaoping and is still often used by the government today. However, the system's internet censors blocked the document. The teacher was able to upload it only after the group of words was removed. Teachers are finding ways to avoid some barriers to sharing information over the internet. For example, they can sometimes share online files with individual students, even as the same documents get rejected when sharing with an online group of students. So some teachers send files to parents and students one by one.
Professor Matthew Delmont decided a few years ago that he wanted to change how he teaches African American history. Delmont teaches at Dartmouth College in the state of New Hampshire. At first, Delmont turned to Twitter. There, he shared stories of the everyday lives of African Americans he read about in black newspapers. That project expanded in November to become the website Black Quotidian. There, readers will find life stories of hundreds of African Americans taken from black newspapers. The stories appeared in publications between the early 1900s and the 1980s. The website contains copies of stories from more than 10 black newspapers, such as the Chicago Defender and the Pittsburgh Courier. It also has audio recordings, pictures, and videos. I felt like my students were coming away from the class only thinking African American history was about these civil rights marches or about martyrs, Delmont said. I felt like they spent so much time thinking about Black Death that they were losing sight of the broader complexity, really the beautiful aspects of African American history. The website shows African Americans who made their mark in sports, politics, the military, and other areas. Among them are icons like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and civil rights activist Rosa Parks. But Delmont also aims to bring attention to lesser-known people. One of them is Juanita Blocker. She was the first black member of the Professional Women's Bowling Association. She wrote about bowling in the Los Angeles Sentinel newspaper for 20 years. The website also tells about Claudette Colvin of Montgomery, Alabama. As a 15-year-old, Colvin refused to give up her seat on a bus 9 months before Rosa Parks did the same. Delmont said, "These iconic figures are important, but we need to understand the everyday people doing important things in their community." He added that he has observed a growing interest in rediscovering overlooked African Americans. Delmont said he hopes the website brings attention to black newspapers. He said the publications were especially important for African American communities that had recently migrated north. The newspapers described people's daily lives. They provided news of everything from politics to sports to weddings. Ethan McKelly worked for the Chicago Defender and wrote a book about the newspaper. He said Delmont's website is offering a fresh look at the role these newspapers played in black communities. Many of the papers included on the website have closed or no longer print newspapers. McKelly said, "I'm very excited about it as kind of serving as the bridge between the past and the present in this way."
The 1997 film Titanic is one of the most popular movies ever made. It won many film awards and was one of the highest-grossing films in movie history. The film is a love story set against the sinking of the famous ship in 1912. It has many memorable scenes. Some of them can teach you important ideas about English grammar. Today, we will explore one short scene to teach you about tag questions and polite forms of speaking. A tag question is a short question added to a statement. In our scene, Jack, played by actor Leonardo DiCaprio, eats dinner with a group of rich people. DiCaprio does not come from a wealthy background. Just the opposite, in fact. He does not have a home. A wealthy woman asks Jack a difficult question. She asks if he enjoys his homeless life. You can hear the tense silence after her question.
And you find that sort of rootless existence appealing, do you?
Well, yes, ma'am, I do.
Let's examine this short exchange. We will begin with the woman's question. The woman's question is a kind of tag question. First, she makes a statement.
And you find that sort of rootless existence appealing?
Notice that the main verb is find. The woman follows the statement with a tag question.
Do you?
If English speakers make a statement that uses a verb other than be, then the tag question often uses an auxiliary verb such as do or have. In this case, the woman made a statement using the verb find, and she used the auxiliary verb do in the tag question. This is just one form that a tag question can take. If you want to learn more about different kinds of tag questions, you can read the story on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now let's continue with the scene. Think about DiCaprio's response to the woman's question. DiCaprio responds by saying,
"Well, yes, ma'am, I do."
The order of DiCaprio's words is important. DiCaprio begins with the word well. Well is a common word that has many uses. Speakers often use well when giving an explanation. DiCaprio then says yes, a term of agreement. The next word is ma'am. Ma'am is a polite term. Americans generally use it to speak to a woman who they do not know. The Online Etymology Dictionary notes that in the United States, speakers generally use ma'am in answers, after the word yes or the word no. In other words, you are more likely to hear Americans say yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. Americans do not use the term ma'am along with a woman's name. DiCaprio uses the words, well, yes, ma'am, to show politeness and to show that an explanation is coming. DiCaprio could have responded in a different, more direct way, as in,
"And you find that sort of rootless existence appealing, do you?"
Yes, I do.
Such a statement would have been a little too strong. That is why DiCaprio did not say it. The point of this story is to show you that you can learn about culture and grammar by watching films or television shows. Even short clips can give you a lot of information. When watching these films or shows, try asking yourself some questions. Why do the speakers say the things they do? Could they change the way they say their lines? These can be difficult questions to answer, but you will learn a lot by thinking about them. A word of advice. It helps if you choose a clip from something that you like, perhaps a film or a show that you have seen before. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By the middle of the 1930s, America seemed to be moving out of the worst depression in its history. Most people supported the New Deal policies of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The dark view that many Americans held during the final days of President Herbert Hoover's administration seemed to be changing. People began to believe that the United States was facing its problems with energy and hope. Harry Monroe and Jack Weitzel tell more about the New Deal programs of President Roosevelt.
The change could be seen in the way that Americans were moving away from extreme political movements of both the right and the left. Many decided that the best solution was to work through the existing political system. Most importantly, Roosevelt's continued experiments with different programs showed Americans that they did not have to blindly follow political or economic traditions. For years, most Americans had accepted the basic ideas of traditional free market capitalism. But as the Depression began, a small number of Americans became interested in the economic ideas of Karl Marx. Roosevelt believed it was best to travel a path between these two opposite ideas. He basically supported the free market system, but he believed government also had a right and responsibility to act when needed, and he supported new government controls in such important areas as banking, transportation, agriculture, and oil production.
Some Americans did not think it was wise or even possible to mix traditional free market capitalism with government intervention or socialism. Former Republican Treasury Secretary Ogden Mills put it this way: "We can have a free country or a socialist one. We cannot have both. Our economic system cannot be half free and half socialistic. There is no middle ground between governing and being governed, between absolute rule and freedom." Many leftists and socialists agreed with conservatives that it was impossible to mix capitalism and socialism. One leftist publication wrote, "Either the nation must live with the sadness of capitalism, or it must prepare to replace capitalism with socialism. There is no longer a practical middle path." However, Roosevelt and his New Dealers happily rejected these arguments. They aimed the country between rightist and leftist extremes and created a whole new set of rules for government, the economy, and democracy.
Most Americans supported Roosevelt and the Democrats as they experimented with new solutions to the problems of the Depression. They elected Democrats to a large majority in Congress in 1934. 2 years later, they re-elected Franklin Roosevelt to a second term in the White House by one of the largest victories in American history. Roosevelt's big victory made him stronger than ever, so he decided to fight the part of the government that had been blocking many of his programs, the Supreme Court.
Most of the 9 judges on the Supreme Court in 1936 were conservative. They had ruled that many of Roosevelt's most important New Deal programs were illegal. Now, the judges were preparing to decide the future of programs to help old people, labor unions, and others. And there was nothing the president could do under the American system of government. So, Roosevelt called for changes in the system. He asked Congress to reorganize the federal judicial system, and he asked for the power to add several new members to the Supreme Court. In this way, Roosevelt hoped to gain a new majority on the court that would support his views.
Most Americans liked Roosevelt, but people of all opinions feared that the president was trying to destroy the careful system of checks and balances in the federal government. They agreed with him in opposing the court's decisions, but they accepted the right of Supreme Court judges to rule as they thought correct. For this reason, the nation rejected Roosevelt's plan to add new members to the court.
Roosevelt's unsuccessful effort to change the Supreme Court came at the same time as the economy began to get worse. Many Americans thought they had defeated the Depression in 1935 and 36. There was steady economic improvement. Some bankers had even begun to fear that the economy was growing too fast. These bankers called on the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, to control the expanding money supply. And the Federal Reserve acted to limit the amount of money in use. At the same time, the federal government began reducing the amount of money that it was spending, and it launched the new Social Security tax on workers' incomes. The effect of all these government actions was to limit the amount of money being spent by the government, companies, and private citizens. As a result, the economy began to fall once again into depression.
In August 1937, stock market prices began to fall sharply. In 7 months, the price of stock for the General Motors Corporation fell from $60 to $25. The United States Steel Company stock fell all the way from $121 to $38. In fact, the stock markets lost in 9 months about two-thirds of all the gains that they had made so slowly and painfully since Roosevelt took office. Americans had supported Roosevelt's New Deal program because it offered a solution to the Depression. Now that program seemed to be failing.
Historian Frederick Lewis Allen remembered those dark days of 1937. Goods sold slowly, Allen wrote. Businessmen became frightened and reduced production. 2 million men were thrown out of work in the space of a few months. They became less able to buy what was for sale. The terrible circle of the falling value of the dollar moved all the more rapidly.
The new economic crisis hurt Roosevelt's popularity, and it came at a time when he faced growing opposition within his own Democratic Party. For several years, conservative Democrats from the southeastern part of the country had supported Roosevelt. They liked his leadership and the power that he brought to all Democrats. But they opposed many of his more liberal or experimental social policies.
As the economy and Roosevelt's popularity fell, many of these Southern Democrats began to openly oppose his leadership. They voted with Republicans on important bills before Congress. Roosevelt became very angry about the new opposition from within his own party. He began to intervene personally in Democratic Party primary elections in 1938. He told party members in several states that they should only vote for candidates who would support his New Deal policies. Roosevelt's opponents accused him of interfering in local politics, and Democratic voters agreed with these criticisms. In almost all cases, they rejected the candidates supported by the president. A few months later, voters in the general election gave the Republicans major gains in both the House of Representatives and Senate.
In most situations, such a change in support would have signaled the end of a president's power. If people will not follow, a president cannot lead or be elected. But such was not the case for Roosevelt and the United States in the late 1930s. It was true that economic and political troubles were not solved, but another crisis was growing larger every day, making these other problems seem less and less important. The crisis was in foreign policy. Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party in Germany seemed ready to make war on Europe, and Japanese forces appeared to be planning new aggression in the Pacific. Americans could no longer just worry about their problems at home. A dark cloud was forming outside their door.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd. Russia and Turkey.